Welcome to Phantom Island, presented by Homefield. Today, it's me, Ryan Nanny, taking the ship's wheel for an episode of Numbers and Words with our pal, Parker Fleming, who you might know as Stats O' War on Twitter and Blue Sky. Parker is the head of analytics at Blueprint Sports, where he works with college programs on NIL and roster building. And we're bringing him on today to talk about a subject that matters very much to a segment of college football fans, the 247 team talent composite. If you have no idea what that means, don't worry. I'm going to do my best to explain it to you.
Every rustle in the trees, a potential snare. Close my eyes and block my ears. Cut the cord and leave me here.
Okay, Parker, thank you for joining me today. We're going to talk about a thing that for certain parts of the college football universe is very exciting, even though I didn't totally understand this until we started talking about it. The release of the 247 team talent composite. Let's first explain to the listener who might have no idea what we're talking about, what the team talent composite is, if we can.
Yeah, team talent composite is really fun. It comes out every year, and basically what the folks over at 247, I'm not entirely sure who at 247 does it. I've talked to like my friend Chris Hummer, and he's like, yeah, I know there's some data people. I'm not actually sure, but what they do is they take their robust data set of players and rankings and rosters, and they do a little math on it to kind of understand how good is your roster, what is the quality of your roster, and we can get as nerdy as you want on that, but it's kind of an interesting broad brush every year of, all right, on the teams on the field, who's the most talented based on our rankings, which, you know, historically, if you talk in terms of hit rates of NFL and second contracts, the ratings are good, right? Obviously, there's going to be exceptions, but a general broad brush of who's got the most talent and really, really interesting to look at and kind of see how teams evolve year over year, kind of really geeky stuff for people who are into team building and, hey, you know, how's my college team going to do over the years of a dynasty as opposed to just one shot this season?
So a couple of caveats we should add to this. Number one, all of this is based on recruits' high school rankings. So if you have a 4-star linebacker who you recruited 3 years ago and he's still on the roster, 247 is saying, like, this is what we think his talent is based on how we rated him as a high school recruit. And that is also, I'm like 90% sure this is true, and I'm only hedging because I couldn't find something definitively from 247 to confirm this. This also doesn't include any re-ranking that's done as part of the transfer portal. So if you got like reassessed in that process, this is just 247 saying, we're looking at your roster based on what we thought of them as high school recruits and giving you a talent composite based on that. But it's not just sort of a like, oh, here's your star total. We added it all up. There is a little bit more finesse to it than that, right?
Yes. To the best of my understanding, you're right on both of those. I went and spot checked some rosters, and I do believe it is that. If it's not, whoever's doing this at 247,
let us
know. I would love to talk to you. By me. let tell me. But yeah, and so the one kind of thing they do to weight it is they rank every roster by rating. So your top 5-star guys, they do it on the composite rating. So they're pulling in some, you know, some industry as well to make sure they're on book. And then, you know, they rate by those ratings, and then they apply just a mathematical weighting. They use a Gaussian distribution with the standard deviation to create a smooth curve, yada, yada, whatever. And I know that they have a little tooltip on their website, and I was able to recreate it from that tooltip. So great explainer, product folks over at 247. And so basically it says, if we just go through and kind of say, all right, player one, player one, player two, player two, how are these rosters compare? And it's weighted towards who's got the most talent. And it bumps up people who have talent at the top rather than balanced rosters.
Right. All right. So let's look through for people who are like, I've never heard of this. I've never looked at it. Let's talk about some of the recent history. So we'll start with this year. This year, this was released just a couple of weeks ago by the time this comes out. The top five in the team talent composite are in order: Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State, Texas, and Oregon. The Alabama part we'll put to the side for the time being, and sort of I'm sure we're going to get into that a little bit. But if you look back at some of the previous years, the last couple of years that we've seen this, last year, the semifinalists in the college football playoff were ranked third. That was Ohio State. Fourth, Texas. Ninth, Notre Dame. And 11th, Penn State. Alabama was number one last year as well. And at the time, they were the most quote unquote talented team in the history of this calculation, which goes back to 2015. 2023, a very similar story. Alabama was number one. Texas was number six. They were one of the the other semifinalist. The two teams in the national championship that year, Michigan was 14th, and Washington was all the way at 26th. So I use that to sort of say that, like any recruiting-based metric, team talent composite has instances where it is not necessarily a predictive measure. It is not a guarantee that if you are super high in this metric, you're going to have an awesome season. If you are super low in this metric, or if you're in the middle in this metric, or relative to your conference members, you're not doing too well, you are absolutely toast. It's an imperfect metric in both directions, I think it's fair to say, right?
For a couple of reasons. I'm going off notes like immediately as we start here, but I've said this a couple times and think this to be true. I think recruiting gets overemphasized and underanalyzed, specifically by fans, because how many ways in college football, how many ways in life, Ryan, do you have an example where you can say the number next to my team's logo is objective and it is higher than my rivals? And like, I just want to maximize that number and go look at the site. We got this recruit. Your recruits are trash. So the nuance does get lost a little bit because it does provide some definitive rankings. And so that matters. And then, there's kind of a couple things with that. So one, Washington, you mentioned Michael Penix was a three-star. I think if we could, you know, look back on his career and regrade him, we would have a different opinion of what that talent was and his development, which goes to the second portion. Recruiting is kind of weird because in some ways it's a lagging indicator of team success. You've gotten good players and then you're going to be good. Some ways it's a leading indicator of team success. Hey, you've been good and then you're going to be a little bit better going forward because of that. And so it's observationally equivalent in these ratings, whether you have a developed bulk of 22 seniors who are going to start, who are all five stars, or you just pulled in the best freshman class of all time. And so there's nuance there. There's also kind of getting us to know, you know, what I originally was thinking about when I first did this revisiting of the team talent composite is it is position agnostic. So if your top five recruit is a safety and your top five recruit is a quarterback, you're getting the same credit, which we just fundamentally know from a football sense is not as informative as to the results on the field.
The other thing I think that's interesting about this is that it is just a talent composite. It just sort of says, like, based on your roster, here's how talented they are. It doesn't, like, obviously this has, we know that injury luck is a big factor on how a team season can go. So this has no bearing on sort of, like, you can have a super talented roster if guys are missing tons of games and you don't have continuity at certain position groups, this, that, or the other. That may be an easy way to explain, like, why team, right, you know, like last year, for instance, I'm not saying this is the explanation necessarily. Last year, Oklahoma was seventh in the team talent composite, barely made a bowl game. So you do see sort of these outliers where it feels like, roughly speaking, team talent composite is a good way to sort of get a good sense of, like, what a team's floor and ceiling should be, but it is not a guarantee that they will hit either of those.
Right. It's not any kind of saying, like, definitively, you know, or shout out to, like, our friend Bud Elliott, who does the blue chip ratio, which is kind of a nice way at the beginning of season to circle who you think is going to be relevant. It doesn't really give us that because there are those Washingtons or Arizona States or I'll show my bias here, those TCUs historically that have had developed teams and been really, really good, even without those extreme high level recruits. And so there's certainly nuance to it. But I do think directionally, if you're asking the question, like, hey, who's recruiting well right now, where should I start looking at? Those are the programs you should start looking at. Or even better yet, who's doing well on the field, but with less talent? Well, let's just compare team talent composite to win probability or wins percentage. And we can start to ask, is that coaching? Or is that, hey, this guy was undervalued and they've got an eval edge? Is that, hey, you're UTEP and you've got Malachi Nelson and you're getting credit for five-star quarterback, so you're way ahead of everyone else in your quarterback or in your conference, even as we know the value of that five-star probably does diminish with the signal of you transferring twice.
So now we're going to talk about a separate thing entirely. And to show our cards to the reader, the listeners here, we're going to put these two things together in a second here. We're going to talk about the franchise tag. This is what I'm going to do my best to explain it. And you're going to fill in and tell me how I've screwed it up. The franchise tag, in its simplest form, is the way for the NFL to calculate how much a top player should be paid, or sort of a, like, top 10-ish player should be paid at a certain position for a single year in the NFL. That's because of the franchise tag system, which, again, dumbing this down to its most basics, sort of allows teams to take one player on the roster who they wouldn't, who's not on an existing contract, and say, okay, you're going to stay with us for one more year, and we're using sort of the market year for your position to decide what we're paying you for that single year. How did I do? How badly did I bungle it?
That was great. That's exactly kind of what it is. It is the top five average of the top five salaries over the last 4 years. It's a rolling window, so it does evolve. And it's a concession from the CBA. So the players gave this to teams, and it's a form of arbitrage. Like in baseball, you know, you can say, hey, I'm in year six, I want arbitrage, and someone decides based on your stats. Yep. It's kind of saying like, hey, you're an elite player. We're not sure about our future plans. Being very good faith with the owners here, we'll say. we're not sure about our future plans. We like you. We can't come to an agreement on a deal. We're going to tag you this year, and we're going to pay you an elite salary for 1 year, and we'll revisit this offseason and figure it out. You can tag players multiple times. It does get more expensive to kind of say, all right, we don't want you to put, you know, but there's not really a lot of opportunities for deals there because you are having to pay top market rates for a guy, but maybe he wants to reset the market and you're not comfortable doing that. So you're like, fine, we'll just pay you in line with that, and we'll talk about it again next year, or maybe you can, you know, we can trade you in and get some of that there. So it hasn't been used a whole ton in history. It's like, I think T. Higgins and Trey Smith are the only two that are tagged this year, and there was eight players last year. But it's kind of implicitly through that structure, it's a reflection of how the NFL values elite talent at different positions. And those positions, just to clarify, because I know there's people listening that are immediately thinking about like, hey, there's position designations. Can I manipulate those? And I think George Kittle has made a joke about he would love to be tagged as a wide receiver, not a tight end, for his production. Or, you know, there's a special teams tag. Well, you can't play Derrick Henry on punt block one time and then say he's a special teamer. We only have to pay him $4 million now. And so there's obviously, you know, some inflexibility around that to kind of keep it to its intended purpose. But overall, it's kind of an idea of the top talent. It's not, Ryan, here's how you should build your roster, right? Because I went through and just added it up. If you tried to fill out a starting 22 of three wide receivers, a tight end, a running back, a quarterback, five linemen, 4-2-5 on defense, you would be paying almost two times the salary cap, right? It's not how to build your roster.
But that's because you would have top five talent at every position in your starting 22.
Yes. And then obviously with the positional importance, like it gets complicated because how do I, you know, with a rookie contract, you're paying someone a sub-market value, but he's producing a lot. How do I value him? And so the franchise tag kind of gives you an idea of how these positions are valued when they're elite, which helps calibrate the market. Agents and front office are looking at this as they negotiate contracts and kind of benchmark. And so really important numbers that are kind of these revealed preferences about what positions are most important on the football field.
Yeah, they are, whether it was meant to do this or not, it is sort of the NFL telling you on a rolling basis, here is what we think we need to prioritize with our salary cap in some weird way. And it's also, I think it's interesting that the positional grouping is not necessarily what you would assume it would be. Like the thing that sticks out to me is that offensive line is just one category, but defensive line is broken down into defensive tackles and defensive ends. Similarly, in the secondary, you have cornerbacks and you have safeties. Like it's granular, but only to a point. Like it's not the kind of thing where the NFL, and maybe this is just because neither party wants to get to this level, but it's not the kind of thing where it's like, okay, here's what slot receivers make. You know, here's what blocking tight ends can get. Here's what third down running backs make. It's really, it wants to offer some positional specificity rather, but it's not going to get into like, really like what do you do and what do other players exactly like you do in the market?
Yes. And there's some ambiguity with like, if you look at the range, you know, what the projections for 26 are, shout out to overthecap.com. Linebacker is up to third behind quarterback and wide receiver, but defensive end is behind offensive lineman. We're like, wait, we know edge is a premium position. Well, like Micah Parsons is a linebacker. And so that's weird that there's some guys that are DNs and some guys that are linebackers that might be playing the same position and moving through all those. So there is some confusion, clarity. Also, like you said, nothing of the volume effects. You have to have five offensive linemen. This offers no guidance for how do I mean, we've seen a resurgence in the market for guards just out of scarcity, and those guys are getting paid crazy money right now. How do we how do we pay, you know, do we need an elite tackle or an elite guard, or do we need two of these guys and spread it around? So it is very, very broad brush when you're talking about team building, but it is a nice kind of directional understanding of what is elite talent worth in the NFL, revealed through what people are paying for elite talent over the last couple of years.
So to go through very briefly what the current rank of franchise tag money looks like, quarterbacks make the most if they get tagged, linebackers, defensive tackles, wide receiver, offensive line, defensive ends, cornerback, safety, tight end, running back, specialists. As you've said, the projections for what this is going to look like in 2026 are actually changing a decent bit. Wide receiver is jumping up a couple of spots, probably to number two. Quarterback's going to stay on top. I can't imagine we'll ever live in a world where that's not the case, frankly, unless we've completely changed the rule book. As you said, linebacker is moving up. The bottom of the list tends to look roughly like defensive backs, tight end, running back, special teams. That sort of occupies the back half of this list pretty consistently, I would say, at least at this point in franchise history, franchise tag history.
Which is like a kind of sobering reality and really hurts the fan in my heart that like the three positions with traditionally the guys that are like the sickest athletes are like, that's kind of the least valuable in the NFL with safety and tight end and running back.
Yeah, it is. There is something disheartening about it. I agree. Thus concludes the free preview portion of this conversation between me and Parker. If you'd like to hear the rest of the episode and get access to everything we publish here at Phantom Island and submit questions for the Single Wing and occasionally get emails from me saying, hey, we're doing a silly thing. Here's a Google form or something to fill out. Go to phantomisland.show and sign up for a paid membership today. Phantom Island is produced by Michael Serber and presented by Homefield. Our theme music by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard comes from the song Phantom Island from their album of the same name. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.